So, I got the thumbs up. Thank you for everyone for coming. Welcome to the AA. I have the privilege today, or this evening, to introduce Daniel Levin Becker, who is our lecturer this evening. He is a member of the Olipo Group, which of course is a group of French and well as American and other nationalities that I'm sure Daniel will talk about. He's a member of the group. They're mathematicians, writers, and also other disciplines. And they call, as part of their group, members such as George Perec, Italo Calvino, Marcel Duchamp, and Harry Matthews. Daniel will be talking about some of them this evening. Daniel also, he's a graduate of Yale University. He is an editor for the Believer Journal. Without further ado, I'll pass the microphone over to him. If you can all welcome Daniel to the AA, and we'll look forward to his talk. Thank you.
Thank you, Ryan. Thank you to the AA for having me. Thank you to the people in the third row with movie popcorn, which is the coolest thing that has ever happened at any reading I've ever given. Can everybody hear me okay? Okay. I'd like to start by just giving a little context on the name of this talk, which is most directly a reference to the title of a book by an Olympian named Jacques Roubaud called La forme d'une ville change plus vite, hélas, que le cœur des humains. Or per the translation by Rosemarie and Keith Waldrop, the form of a city changes faster, alas, than the human heart. That title is a nod to Baudelaire, who said in a parenthetical aside in a poem about swans that the form of a city changes faster, alas, than the heart of a mortal. And thoroughness also compels me to mention that The Shape of the City is also the name of a book about Nantes by Julien Gracq, but that's the last I will say about him. I chose the title in part because I'm really bad at titles unless I quote other people, and in part because I think both the phrase and the book to which it refers, or the book that uses it for its name, are very good places to start talking about the Olipo's urban explorations. And I want to make the disclaimer right now that the Olipo's explorations are much more diverse than the scope of this talk. They're inspired and governed by everything from the purely theoretical, like mathematics and linguistics, to the purely happenstance. But the city is sort of an ideal conceptual middle ground for the group and its preoccupations, because for all their chaos and chance, cities are built environments, systems made up of many smaller systems, and also because cities are constantly brimming and bustling with language in a wonderful cacophony of forms, like overheard speech and wayfinding signage and advertisements and t-shirt slogans and so on. So before I go any further, I'll just say a few words about the Olipo more generally. The group was founded in 1960 in Paris by Raymond Queneau and François Le Lyonnais. And it was conceived initially as a seminar on the history of experimental literature. Over time, this evolved into a workshop, and the word Olipo is an acronym in French for Ouvroir de littérature potentielle, or workshop for potential literature. Over time, the workshop started to focus on exploring how formal structures, often in the guise of rules and constraints, can unlock a specific kind of creativity. The group is officially anti-chance, owing to a falling out Queneau had with the Surrealists in the 1920s. And while it's not dedicated solely to constraint as a generative tool, it is chiefly oriented toward thinking about literature not as an open-ended question of inspiration, but as a problem with a discrete set of solutions. The only official definition that the group has for itself is rats who build the labyrinth from which they plan to escape. There are currently 40 members in the group, of whom 30 are French, 35 are men, 19 are dead, and one is imaginary. Our bylaws state that members who are dead are permanently excused from attending monthly meetings, but are still counted as members. And our bylaws also state that nobody can quit or be kicked out of the Olipo, even in death. The only way to leave the group is to commit suicide with the express and exclusive purpose of leaving the Olipo, and to do so in the presence of a notary. And I'm happy to report that in almost 60 years of operation, nobody has yet availed him or herself of that loophole. I joined the group in 2009 and became its second American member. The first, as Ryan mentioned, is Harry Matthews, who died almost 2 weeks ago in Florida. And actually, technically speaking, the first American member was Marcel Duchamp, who became a member in 1962 and was already an American citizen by then, but we don't tend to count him that way. Anyway, the Ulipo is still based in Paris and holds monthly private meetings and gives quite a lot of public readings and lectures. And the next one will be a tribute to Harry Matthews on the 23rd at the main branch of the National Library, and you are all hereby invited. And I'm sure I'm forgetting some important stuff, and I hope you'll hold me to account for it later at the Q&A part, but I want to get back to Roubaud and the Form of a City, which is a book of pedestrian poems, as Roubaud calls them. As a rule, he composes his poems while walking through Paris or occasionally other cities. And it was written in part in response to a book by Queneau from 1967 called Courir les Rues, which was translated a few years ago by Rachel Galvin as Hitting the Streets. Queneau, who again was the co-founder of the group, was born in Le Havre, but was very much a Parisian for most of his life. And the city is almost always present in his work, if only as a backdrop. One of his most famous books, Exercises in Style, relates the same mundane anecdote in 99 different ways, but the anecdote takes place on a city bus and then in front of the Gare Saint-Lazare. Another one is Zazie in the Metro, which is about a foul-mouthed little girl from the provinces who comes to visit Paris, and all she wants to do is ride the metro, but of course it's on strike the whole time that she's there. But Hitting the Streets is explicitly a record of the rhythms and noises and idiosyncrasies of Paris. And Roubaud spends a lot of time in the Form of a City looking for traces of Queneau and his poems, creating one more link in a long chain of writers sensing and meditating on each other's presence in Paris. Hence the nod to Baudelaire, hence also, for that matter, Queneau claiming that when he moved to Paris as a teenager, he already knew the city intimately because he had read Balzac. So Roubaud goes around and he overhears people talking in the same clipped and demotic language that fascinated Queneau. He gives people directions, he sits in cafes, he takes the metro, he inventories the streets whose names don't contain the letter E, and the streets whose names don't contain any vowels besides E. He makes observations like that the rue pavée is no longer paved. And he thinks about his poet predecessors and his friends and death and the passage of time. Here's the first poem. The Paris we find to traipse is not the one we used to find, and we're not wild to get to the Paris we will leave behind. That's the translation by Keith and Rosemary Waldrop, which I don't love, but you get the idea. It's that bittersweet and very true notion that the city we move through is both the same and not the same as the one that our forebears did, just as it's both the same and not the same as one future generations will inhabit. And just for context and to show you how indebted this collection is to Queneau, here's the Queneau poem from 1943 that it's based on. The Paris that you loved is not the one that we love, and we are moving in no hurry toward the one we will forget. Topographies, itineraries, rambles across town, memories of bygone hours, how difficult memory is. And without a map, no one will understand us, because it's all just a game of forgetting lost time. That's my own quick and dirty translation. So I probably shouldn't have impugned the Waldrop's version of the previous poem, because at least that one had the decency to keep the rhyme. But as you see, this one goes into a little more detail on the same idea, pinpointing some of the things that actually get lost over time. The city's textures, its timetables, the way we wander it aimlessly, and the way that even documenting these things won't give our successors the true sense of what it was like to be in this place at this time. I also want to note that the word dérive in the second line of the second stanza was taken up about a decade later by the Situationists, who politicized the idea of aimlessly wandering into a revolutionary practice of what they called psychogeography. And that the reference in the third stanza to un plan sous les yeux, a map under the nose, is what the Ulipians call an anticipatory plagiarism of the Situationist hobby of navigating one city using a map of a different city. This has all been sort of an extended preamble by way of saying what I want to talk about this evening is not only that bittersweet but very true notion that a city is constantly changing right under our feet, but also how this idea gets reflected and refracted and raged against by a group of writers and mathematicians who are collectively sworn to abjure chance and who are in love with the kind of mastery and order that come from getting to know the systems of a city, its street layouts, its neighborhood demographics, Its train routes and bus timetables, its indelible history, and its history that seems to be written in sand. And it's not an accident that Paris is the city in question for most of these works I'll be talking about, both because that's where most Oulipians live and work, and because Paris is one of the world's great cities, as is London, he hastened to add. It's intricate and quirky and both constantly changing and utterly resistant to change. And also because the arrondissements in Paris are laid out in a spiral pattern, which reminds us Oulipians of a treasured poetic form from the 14th century called the Sestina, which is also based on permutations in a spiral pattern. And I won't go off on this tangent, but I would very much like to hear one day a talk about the affective impact of the literal shape of a city on the nature of its poetry. The way that Paris is shaped in a spiral and New York is a grid and San Francisco is like a dozen grids mashed together at apparently random angles and so on. Anyway, what I want to do in the time that remains is take a selective inventory of some of the Oulipian work that uses place, the urban environment in particular, as a theme or as a constraint. And I'd wanted to categorize these works because I'm an Oulipian and Oulipians love taxonomy. But what I found the more time I spent with these examples is that they're surprisingly resistant to distinct categorization. They tend to run together and inflect and borrow and steal from one another in much slipperier ways than the way Rubeau's poems relate to Canot's poems. Most Oulipian work is like this, to be honest. The lines between them are superficial and sometimes illusory, perhaps in a sense like geographical borders. Which brings me belatedly to the second half of the title of this talk, La Ville d'une Forme, or the city of a form, which is to say that within the Oulipo especially, projects like these tend to evolve by processes of collaboration and contagion, by being inhabited by multiple people with different origins and agendas. Like a city, an Oulipian form has its own shape and its own multitudes, its own rules and people who obey them and other people who subvert and pervert them. So the categories I'm going to present are bounded by soft borders. Think of them more like dots that I'm going to connect in one way, but also encourage you to connect them in your own way. But each soft category that I'm going to talk about, bless you, is a certain way of using the city as a generative device. And the first one I want to get out of the way, because it's the most basic and the least specifically Oulipian, is the use of the city as an abstraction. Not just as a backdrop, even a very relevant backdrop, like in Georges Perec's Life, a User's Manual, which takes place entirely within an apartment building on an imaginary street in Paris, or like Anne Garreta's Sphinx, which was translated into English last year, which moves from Paris to New York and changes its tone accordingly, or Lille in Lina Monk's Plouctown, or Lisbon in Hervé Letellier's Electrico W. I'm thinking more of the city not as a specific place, but as a human or political construct. Many of you have probably read Italo Calvino's Invisible Cities. I recently learned that Calvino is the second most cited author among star architects, second only to Walter Benjamin. Invisible Cities describes many imagined and sort of dreamlike spaces, each of which is referred to as a city, but among them, the only real constant is the idea of a city that is just that, it's an idea. And Calvino develops and challenges that idea in some ways very systematically and in some ways quite impressionistically by adding or subtracting the elements that we take for granted in what a city is. For instance, how the space is laid out physically. This is an artist's depiction of a city called Zenobia, which is a city on stilts. And also things like who inhabits the city, the way the city embodies our memories and our dreams and our desires. Invisible Cities is a highlight of Canot's later career, once he was already a member of the Oulipo. But I also want to just mention that even in the decades prior, he was already working in a similar vein. For instance, in the story collection Marco Valdo, which was published in 1963, but written over about 10 years beforehand, the subtitle of Marco Valdo is Seasons in the City, and it follows the passage of time via seasons in an industrial city in northern Italy, as seen through the adventures and hardships of the title character. And the city is never named, but it's always present as both a real place and as an idea, acting on Marco Valdo and his family, sometimes as an antagonist, sometimes as a trickster, sometimes as the source of unexpected and delightful encounters. So for Calvino, the city can be as much a philosophical unity as it is a real location, and that is a strain that is present in Oulipian work. On the other end of the spectrum is a much more uniquely Oulipian way of using cities, not as philosophical unities or real locations, but as source material.
And when I say source material, I don't mean in the sense of inspiration. I mean it literally in the material sense of parts or ingredients or nuts and bolts. Cities that are used to provide names or words or sounds to work with. So this is a spread from a book by Michel Grangot called Stations, or Stations, published in 1990, which is a book of anagram poems, each of which is constructed using the letters in the names of Parisian metro stops. Grangot is so gifted technically that she can use a radically limited alphabet like this one to make these poems feel germane to Paris in their own way, but it's nonetheless a very abstract way. You'd have to dig really deep to find a Paris that a non-resident would recognize as Paris, which is a wonderful thing, artistically speaking, but woe betide the tourist who picks up that book looking for a guide to getting around the city. And Grangot's work tends to be very serious, but that's the exception, really, rather than the norm for this kind of approach to city writing. A more common example would be this game, which is referred to as something called Ulipo Light. And this game is called the Chicago, invented by Roubaud and Paul Fornell, in which you get a set of four words or phrases that conform to a certain syntactic and synonymic pattern, and you have to guess the fifth, and the fifth will also be the homonym of the name of a city. The answer here is, anyone? Come on. The answer here is Baghdad. And just another example, this is an extremely Ulipian project made by somebody who's not actually in the Ulipo named Daniel Lehman, and it's called Ulipolitain de Paris. And what it does is it transposes a series of words that differ by one letter each. At the top, for instance, you can see tour, tire, mire, mile, or in French, tour, tire, mire, and mille, onto a map of the Parisian metro. So each metro stop is replaced with one of these words, and each metro line is a separate chain of words, but when two lines intersect, so do the chains of words. So all of these are impressive and, I think, gratifying uses of the city as source material, but it wouldn't be unfair, to call them superficial. In order to get where they're going, they sort of hollow out any experience of the city as a place and use the shell of the city to create something only nominally related to it. Which is not to say that there aren't some deeper truths about the specific place to be found or about places in general. Ulipians tend to be firm believers in the intellectual value of the superficial, but that's hardly the foreground of the project. As a way of using the unique potentiality of a given place, these are quite glancing. But there are other projects that use the city and its attributes as an organizing principle in a similar way, while also beginning to let in the environment a little bit more. An exemplary case is a form invented in 1990 by Jacques Jouet, who is one of the most active and prolific members of the group, and it's called the Poème de Métro, or the subway poem. Such a poem is written on the subway during the subway trip, and it contains one fewer lines than the trip contains stops from beginning to end. You get on the train, and when the train starts moving, you compose the first line of a poem in your head, and when the train makes its first stop, you write it down. When the train starts again, you begin to compose the second line, and so on. No writing while the train is moving, no composing while the train is stopped. If you change to a different train line, you start a new stanza. When you arrive at your destination, you stop on the platform and write down the last line, and then you get on with whatever you were doing, wherever you were going to take the metro. In 1996, Jouet decided to write the exhaustive metro poem, using a route planned out by another Ulipian who was a graph theorist named Pierre Rosenstiel. He took a single trip that passed through every single station in the entire Parisian metro system, which took 15 and a half hours, and culminated in a poem that is 490 lines long. And then a few months later, he did the same thing, but took the route backwards. Much more recently, Jacques Roubaud published an extended ode to line 29 of the Parisian bus system, and the book is structured as a ride from one terminus to the other, which in classic Roubaud form contains a lot of digressions in both thought and rhyme scheme, which are reflected on the right in different colors. So what these forms have in common, both with each other and with more conventional instances of travel writing, is that they allow the living, breathing qualities of the place, whether the place is stationary or mobile, to penetrate the formal edifice. The methods themselves are repeatable and could be used anywhere else with the right municipal infrastructure. You could write a subway poem on the London Tube, for instance, and you absolutely should because it's very fun and challenging and nothing like what you think it is. But the specific stimuli wouldn't be the same, and so the result wouldn't be the same either. You wouldn't hear the same noises, and the same languages around you wouldn't pass through the same stations that are either totally blank in their associative valence or full of accreted personal associations, and you wouldn't have the same relationship to the environment that you're moving through. Which is, of course, a set of personal distinctions, but then these are still personal poems. They're rooted in the poet's sensibility and impressions and mind. They reflect the surroundings as well, though, which is partially the point. This is an excerpt from early on in Jouet's exhaustive metro poem in Jordan Stump's translation. And you see him thinking about the project, the train he's on, the sky and the Seine, and only eventually does awareness of his fellow travelers begin to make its way in. I'll just read some of it. It starts, "I'm not entirely convinced my itinerary will stay on track, though calculated to the minute, with what must surely be a minimal margin of error. The first emergence into the open air at Bel Air, as it happens, is unspectacular, as night is still upon us." A little bit later, he says, "The first Seine of the day leads me to drop my glasses to my paper. The first Seine and the first worksite, if I exclude the green shed on the platform at République, my place of departure, full of tools and workmen's trinkets. Already I've said us without asking my fellow travelers' permission, which is an exaggeration in perfect harmony with the nature of the Orphic character who, this morning, takes himself for the seated scribe of an entire dynasty of movers and shakers for a day. At D'Enfer Rochereau, for the first time, my paper attracts the curious gaze of a sharp-eyed incomer in deep red skirt, jacket, two bags, on one bag an embroidered globe with circling rocket, and I know that I am just then passing very close by the Rue Mison." So there's this mix of stimuli, some of which are specific to the place, some of which are totally interior. And so like in Queneau's and Roubaud's Paris poems, the place organizes the text, and the text organizes the place at its own pace, in its own rhythm. The text is the product of a push and pull between the poet and the place. I wrote that sentence very pleasingly alliterative. I hope you enjoyed it. But it's also necessarily about the push and pull that's going on. Moving along the continuum, we now approach works that use the city or the environment as material to be interpreted or inventoried or annotated or transcribed. This is a page from a book called L'Herbier des Villes, or The City Herbarium, for which Hervé Letellier went around Paris picking up discarded objects from the street and wrote a haiku for each one. And this one, which is a picture of a crushed water bottle, translates to, "All the water in the world has been pissed 7 times by a dinosaur." The most famous of this kind of documentary project is almost certainly Georges Perec's Tentative d'épuisement d'un lieu parisien, which has been translated a couple of times, but whose most accessible English translation is Mark Lowenthal's An Attempt to Exhaust a Place in Paris. Perec spent 3 days in October 1974 sitting in different locations on the Place Saint-Sulpice, notating what he observed as factually and dispassionately as he could. The project was an outgrowth of Perec's interest in what he called the infraordinary, the register of experience beneath the surface of everyday life, which is quite a situationist notion, too, when you think about it. And at the beginning of the book, he explains that he's looking to pinpoint what happens when nothing happens other than the weather, people, cars, and clouds. So here's a sample. It's 4:05, weary eyes, weary words. An apple green, deux CV. I'm cold, I order a brandy. Across the street at the Tabac, the bridge players from the second floor are getting some air. A motorcycle cop parks his motorcycle and enters the Tabac. He comes back out almost immediately. I don't know what he bought. Cigarettes, a ballpoint pen, a stamp, cashew, a packet of tissues? Citirama bus. A motorcycle cop. An apple green Citroën van. The urgent sounds of a car horn are audible. A granny pushing a baby carriage. She's wearing a cape. A mailman with a satchel. A racing bike attached to the back of a low car. So as a book, it's sort of hypnotically boring to read, just as the experience itself must have been, and you can think of it as either a failure or a success, or perhaps a success by virtue of its failure. Perec never quite manages to take himself out of the picture, and there's no conclusion of any kind. It just stops when it stops. It truly is, as he says, what happens when nothing happens. Nonetheless, it's a fascinating snapshot of a place and time, and unavoidably of its narrator. You get the feeling that, like a subway poem, Perec could have used the same method in any other city, and the outcome would have been fundamentally similar and fundamentally different. Perhaps more poignantly, you get the feeling that he could have done the same thing with the following week or the following year, and that only over time, parsing the growing differences among iterations, would anything resembling a conventional narrative begin to emerge. Perec actually had another project, which he never finished, called Lieux, or Places, for which he chose 12 spaces in Paris that had sentimental significance to him, and described each of them over the course of several years at regular intervals, both from memory and by visiting them. And every time he finished a new description, he would seal it away like a time capsule so he wouldn't be influenced by more recent associations. And he said he wanted to capture with this project three kinds of vieillissement, or three kinds of aging: the aging of places, the aging of his memories, and the aging of himself. Valérie Baudouin, who's an active member of the ILIPO who doesn't write very much, did a similar project a few years ago here in London. During her regular commute on the Northern Line, she observed what people were doing and recorded these facts against a rough layout of the train car. So the text that she produced, which is called Northern Line, reads sort of like a mobile version of Perec's Saint-Sulpice experiment. For the most part, it's more successful at being impartial and impassive, but she still allows herself to be present some of the time, like here where she wonders what the man in the northeast corner of the car is doing without moving his arms. Like Perec's project, Northern Line also bears faint marks of the time when it was made. There's an MP3 player, a smartphone, their physical newspapers haven't quite disappeared yet, and I suspect that this dimension will start to seem a lot more significant the further away we get in time from 2013 when she did the project. I will note, though, that I reread the text yesterday while I was on the Northern Line, and it was quite striking how many people in my car were doing the things that she describes here, yawning or chatting or fiddling with their mobile devices. But it's also then stimulating to think about how this exercise would differ not only at a different time, but in Paris, or in New York, or in Tokyo. Here, on the other hand, is a micro-specific in situ form called the rhumb, invented very recently by Frédéric Forté. You write a rhumb by recording and meditating on what you see in each of the eight directions on a compass rose, with the length of each line being proportional to how far your visual field extends in that direction. So if I were to write one right now, the line facing this way would be extremely short, the line facing that way would be much longer, these lines would be of medium short length. And the title of the rhumb is the longitude and latitude of the place where it was composed, and one of the eight lines mentions the direction that it points in for orientation purposes, because the final poem can be read starting from any of the points, clockwise or counterclockwise. So this example, which is an Ian Monk's translation, was written in Paris, and it goes, I'm going to start from the upside down, westward facing one. The ring road's the border, beyond vague details, unless my eyesight, or showing the other, northwest side of things. Land's end, apparently. On the other side, the safe world. Wasteland and fiduciary zone, a negligible hole. Weeds for even more security. The street molts, always transitory. Second floor in construction. And this is taken from a collective volume called Paris Math, or Paris Maths, a tour of the streets in Paris that are named after mathematical figures, which was put together by the mathematician Olympian Michel Audin, and which should come out later this year. The use of space that I want to talk about is as a surface on which to write texts themselves. Works that aren't necessarily composed in situ, but that are published out in the world, so to speak, and live there for an indefinite period of time. Generally, these are public installations instigated by somebody who's been given control of a budget that they shouldn't have been entrusted with and calls on the ILIPO to create something to adorn their public space. And there are a number of them around France at universities and in parks and metro and tram stations. And the example that I'm going to show you is a series of oversized nails driven into the ground on the Esplanade Charles de Gaulle in Rennes. Each of the nails has a little bit of text on it. Here's what they look like up close. And here for scale is a picture of one of the nails next to Jacques Roubaud's feet. Perec has a wonderful long essay called Espèces d'espace, which is translated by John Sturrock as Species of Spaces, which I've noticed is available for purchase in your beautiful bookshop. where he meditates on different types of spaces, from the bed to the bedroom, to the street, to the town, to nation, to the planet, to space in general. But he begins with the page, and he plays around with the spatial qualities of a page of text, the body, the margins, the footnotes, each of which is charged with a different kind of poetic valence. And so in a sense, the public installations like the nails in Rennes are an extension into the real world of that desire to inscribe different parts of the page, especially the parts where you don't normally put anything. And interestingly, the Ulipo's real world texts tend not to speak much about the places where they're installed, just as when you think about it, most writing doesn't speak much about the paper that it's printed on. Most, although the Ulipo sort of throws off that count. But it almost always says something about the acts of reading and writing. So for instance, the salient constraint for the nails in Rennes, which are arranged in the pattern that I showed you a couple slides ago that looks like a subway system but isn't, is that each succession of nails has to read coherently no matter which way the reader is walking or which way the walker is reading. So nail by nail, each text is a palindrome. So this is the extremity of the northwest line, and you could read it like this. Far off is the end, but at the end is a goal, and the goal is the path, all of it zigzagging, bucolic or urban, complicated. Or like this, complicated, urban or bucolic, zigzagging, all of it. The path is the goal, and a goal is at the end, but the end is far off. In 2010, when this project was being prepared, there was some internal disagreement among the Ulipians involved about how much guidance pedestrians should be given as readers. Roubaud, for example, was concerned that without a map of the proper trajectories, potential readers would be confused. And Anne Garita, who was also involved, replied that the readers would create their own paths. In an email she wrote, "They will generate the uses. This is potentiality at work." So, there's a lot more to be said about the particular experience of the reader or the inhabitant of a spatial text like this, but I want to take a detour and start heading towards a conclusion by taking hold of this idea of potentiality. And I remind you that this idea, potentiality, is inscribed within the Ulipo's very name, potential literature, and that all of the ways that I've talked about using the urban environment as abstract inspiration, as source material, as a set of rules, or as a space on which to write for other people are different ways of beholding and engaging with that environment's potential. I also want to return to a theme that's come up once or twice already, which is exhaustion. It's prominent, most notably, in the curious way that Perec chose to refer to his Saint-Sulpice project, an attempt to exhaust a place, and also pretty implicit in the arduous 15 and a half hour journey that Jouet took to write his exhaustive metro poems. To put these terms in a little more historical context, the Ulipo's founders were initially interested in potential primarily as an end unto itself. Le Lyonnais said that it was sufficient to demonstrate the potentiality of a form or of a constraint, and that any texts that were written by using that form or constraint were bonuses, but inessential. But as the group began to age, newer members, starting with Perec, and then including Calvino and Jouet and Grangot and Forte, started shifting the group's focus toward creation, toward taking the potential of a form and constraint and using it to make things. Now, obviously, there's some distance between making things and exhausting potential, but I would argue that exhaustion of a constraint or of a tool or of the author, or hopefully not, but inevitably sometimes of the reader, is the logical terminus of the Ulipian drive to write. Not just to write a book without the letter E, as Perec famously did, but to write a sequel to that book where E is the only vowel that's allowed. Not just to travel a route that crosses through all of the Parisian metro stops, but to do the same thing again backwards. So potential in a city is precisely that which cannot be exhausted. A city is inherently and profoundly kinetic. It's infinite, to quote the title of a book by Rebecca Solnit. And the more time I spent thinking about the works that I've been talking about this evening, the more evident it became to me that the thread tacitly uniting them is how, one way or another, they all testify to the way that we are exhausted by the city. Each of these rigidly conditional kinds of situatedness, from using the names of metro stops to make anagrams, to sitting in one place at length and trying to observe everything that isn't anything that goes on there, is the author's attempt to exhaust himself or herself as an observer of that place in that moment, to fall on the sword of potentiality, and in doing so, paradoxically, both confirm and perpetuate the city's inexhaustibility. As Garita recognized, this is what readers always do. They renew and multiply the potentiality of a work, and by proxy, everything that went into making it. And that is, among other things, why you have that chain of writers wandering around Paris looking for echoes of other writers, to keep those transient times and places alive. And I'm convinced that this is a boon for the reader, even though, or rather because, it's totally useless from a practical standpoint. Perec's book about Saint-Sulpice would be an awful historical document and would be an awful tourist guide to Saint-Sulpice. In fact, to sit in Place Saint-Sulpice and read it today is, I think, not so different from that psychogeographic trick of walking around London using a map of Lisbon. But that disorientation is why we read literature. Not just to learn about what once was and no longer is, or still is, and not just to learn about the particular failure of the person who tried to preserve it the way it was, but also to learn new ways of looking and seeing, new frameworks to engage with and remember what's around us right now. Place in all of the works we've looked at is simultaneously core and red herring. Because when the city changes faster than we do, when no two people can ever technically inhabit it in exactly the same fashion, maybe place is nothing but a location-specific series of perpetually obsolescing moments. And I want to close with something that Perec once wrote. Je cherche en même temps l'éternel et l'éphémère, which means I am seeking the eternal and the ephemeral at the same time. It's a remarkable sentence, first and foremost, because it is what Ulippians call a monovocalism, which is to say it uses no vowels besides the letter E, but also because it sums up so concisely the project of trying to write a place into existence. And I'm not trying to be glib or dramatic when I say that all places are eternal and ephemeral at the same time. I just mean that from moment to moment and from person to person, they dissipate as powerfully and as interestingly as they endure. The city changes and we change, it ages and we age, it forgets and so do we. And perhaps the real insight behind all of these oblique or playful or solemn uses of the city as a writing tool is that writing is ultimately no different from place in this respect. They're both ways of approaching immortality in a very human way, in that they're never finished being exhausted. Thank you. And I will be happy to try to answer some questions.
Would anyone like to ask some questions for Daniel?
I'm as someone who's fairly new to the Ulipo movement and learning about it, how do you place yourself as a member of the Ulipo with other writers who kind of don't follow any kinds of constraint and in a sense can still convey quite a lot about a city but not with the same methodology?
Mm-hmm. So a really core principle of the Ulipo is that our explorations as a research group are meant to create forms and structures that could be useful to any writer, whether or not those writers are interested. But there's a very careful intent not to say that what we do, the way we approach writing through constraint, is the way that anyone should do it. It's these are ways that are available to you if, for instance, you're finding that inspiration is not coming. What if instead of trying to be inspired, you just work in a way that you didn't think of a text as requiring work? And so writing about place, with constraint or without constraint, is just like writing any other kind of literature with constraint or without constraint. These are tools that say, here is a way of engaging with this place in a way that's conducive to a sort of mindset that's often obsessive, also often needy for knowledge or needy for a certain kind of certainty. But if you don't like it, there is nothing that obligates you to use any of it. Take it if you want it. Otherwise, best of luck to you.
Hi. I just wondered why, or if you think there is a British lack of involvement in Ulipo.
There's not a British lack of involvement. There is as much British involvement as there is American involvement. There's currently there's the active British member is Ian Monk, who is a brilliant poet in both French and English, and a translator of a lot of work, including some of Perec's most constrained texts, like the novel that doesn't use any vowels besides E. Then there, Stanley Chapman was another member who died a few years ago. What I think you're asking, and correct me if I'm wrong, is a more specific version of, is the Ulipo necessarily French? And sort of wagging your head skeptically.
Yeah, or do we get it?
Well, I can't answer that. It's certainly true to say that the Ulipo happens in French, and I think that is rooted in a number of things, most particularly the French relationship to language as a set of structures and a set of rules, because the way that the French learn French prioritizes and in some ways fetishizes structure and correctness a lot more than English is learned in America, certainly, and I would guess in England. And so there's an inherited desire to both obey and disobey rules that I think animates the French Ulipian mindset, which is not to say that it's exclusively French. As it happens, you have to speak French at least a little bit to join the Ulipo, because French is just the language in which our work is conducted. But in America, for instance, there are many like-minded poets. In Canada, there are quite a lot of like-minded poets who work in English. And same with Brazil and a number of other countries who that are not coming to mind right now. There are outcroppings of this kind of tradition and this kind of relationship to writing, maybe not to language as much, throughout the world. And the Ulipo is just a French, I think it's the most prominent and the most long-standing formalized version of that philosophy.
So I was just wondering, how do you start approaching kind of setting up a set of constraints or a system? Because you have kind of this thing about anti-chance, but well, when setting up a system of constraints, you have to kind of choose what to make a rule and what not to make a rule. Mm-hmm. And then that kind of feels like, do you kind of make something a rule that kind of comes to mind, or do you follow a set of rules to make those rules? I don't really know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a good question. So the Ulipo is anti-chance but not anti-choice, which I think is an important important distinction. But there's also a separation between the choice of constraint and then obeying that constraint blindly or religiously, which is to say that we're not so doctrinaire that we constrain ourselves with the choice of constraints that we use. So Roubaud has a sort of dictum that the best Ulipian works relate, the content of the work relates to the constraint that it's written under in some way. It doesn't necessarily talk about it, the best example of that being Perec's La Disparition, which is his novel that he wrote without the letter E, which is about a world in which the letter E has disappeared, and everyone is scrambling to figure out what is going on, and as soon as anyone tries to articulate it, they spontaneously drop dead. That's a sort of orthodox example, but choosing the constraint that suits your project best, that gives voice to what you want to accomplish or challenges what you want to accomplish, is something that is very much up to the practitioner. And I'll just add to that that the Ulipo contains both writers and mathematicians, or writers and scientists in a broader sense, and that a lot of the choice of constraints, especially in the more sophisticated algorithm-based, for instance, or Jouet's exhaustive metro poem, the constraint at work is the fruit of a collaboration between the writer, who has a sense of what he or she wants to accomplish, and somebody who's more skilled in graph theory, for instance, in Rosenstiel's case, or Life, a User's Manual, Perec wrote with a guy named Claude Berge, who helped him map out the algorithm that determined how the narration moved around from space to space. And that is one of the ways in which the Ulipo is most collaborative as a research group. But in short, anti-chance does not mean that we can't have sort of idiosyncratic human ways of choosing the rules that we follow.
Any additional questions?
Hi, I was wondering, how do you become a member of the group today?
Another one of our bylaws is that anyone who asks to become a member is permanently ineligible for membership. The protocol tends to be, you do work that attracts the attention of the ULIPO. I sort of snuck in by, I had a research grant to help catalog the ULIPO's archives in Paris at the National Library, and I got to know some of the members, and they became aware of some of the work that I was doing, both in writing this book about the ULIPO called Many Subtle Channels, which Ryan forgot to plug. It's a triumph of literary criticism. They were, yeah, there it is. Very lavish margins. So they were aware that I was working on this and also doing some more actually ULIPian work of my own. But what happens, whether you've published or happen to know a member of the group personally, what happens is an ULIPian will bring up at one of the monthly meetings work that somebody is doing that is interesting. And if enough people are interested, that person will be invited to one of the monthly meetings to present his or her work and just sort of talk about what he or she is doing that may be related to or tangential to the ULIPO's current work. And then after that presence at a monthly meeting, some guests are elected unanimously and others are not. I feel like that's an unsatisfying answer, but.
Where are the monthly meetings?
In Paris.
You go to Paris every month.
I do not go to Paris every month. I mostly just read the minutes from the meetings, which are very scrupulously and artistically taken, usually by Michel Audin. Sometimes I Skype in, which is sort of a delightful comedy of errors most of the time. But when I am in Paris, I go. But it rotates. It's usually at somebody's house over dinner. Sometimes if enough ULIPians are traveling to do a reading or a workshop or something, that it'll be off-site. But it's almost always in Paris.
Hi. In the various works of the ULIPO, how much is a constraint simply a tool, and how much is the reader supposed to, like, what's the intention? Is the reader meant to understand fully the constraints behind the piece of writing he's reading, or, you know, do you recommend that he knows it beforehand or not know of them at all?
That's a terrific question. That is probably the most active philosophical debate within the ULIPO. There are some people, Jacques Jouet, for instance, believes that the reader should always know the constraint or the organizing principle of the text, because if the organizing principle or constraint plays the role it's supposed to in the production of the text, then to not know about it would be to miss out on an important part of the final product. On the other hand, somebody like Harry Matthews felt very, very vehemently that it was a better and more stimulating experience for the reader to know that there was a constraint, but not necessarily what the constraint was. So its short answer is it depends on the practitioner. I am sort of agnostic about it because I have not written very many things that have a constraint that could be construed as secret, but I forgot what I was gonna say after that. Sorry. I think there are good arguments for both, and it sort of just depends both on the practitioner and on the work and how the work that you read as a final product interacts with the way it was composed.
Any further questions?
Obviously, since you use constraints, is there a limit, like by your laws, is there a limit that of constraints you use? Or you can say, okay, I'm just using one, or are there multiple all the time? How does, like, if you already decide you're doing what you're dealing with the constraints, how is there a limit?
No. Again, it depends on the practitioner and depends on the work. So for instance, Perec's novel without the letter E is a very simple constraint, and that's the only one, as far as I know. It just doesn't contain the letter E. Whereas Life a User's Manual has like several dozen different constraints that are operating. And there's, you know, there's one master, there are technically two master constraints that structure the book. And then each chapter has its own things that have to happen or things that have to be mentioned, and there has to be one thing that's off, and there has to be one hidden quotation from an author, and there was, at some point in the 90s, basically the blueprint, the cahier des charges, the blueprints for Life a User's Manual were published, and it's a book that is almost as long as Life a User's Manual itself. So anywhere between those two poles, I have written texts that started out with one constraint, and I got a ways and then sort of ran into some stasis, and then realized that adding additional constraints was a way of helping myself get over that hump. And I think it's also possible that the opposite happens, that you set out to do a text that is constrained in four different ways, and then you realize that one of the constraints is not helping you, which, to your question, is that's totally allowed, you know.
Doesn't that make the constraints on the city sort of because you have to deal with the unexpected nature of the city?
Sure. Yeah.
That the altering of them become quite important within mm-hmm. the urban project.
Yeah, I think that kind of suppleness. A lot of the anagrams of the metro stations maybe a little more of an exception, but a lot of the forms that I've talked about there's sort of some suppleness built into them, or the form is sort of floats above the nitty-gritty of the urban experience just enough that if something crazy happens, Jacques Jouet, the first poem in the collected book of subway poems is sort of the auto-definitional poem. And it says, it's a metro poem about writing metro poems. And the last sort of explains line by line what happens, basically like the explanation that I gave you earlier. And the last line is, if the train you are on should stop suddenly between two metro stops, it is always a delicate moment in the writing of a metro poem.
One more quick question. What happens to the role of the translator? Because I'm just wondering, for example, in the Perec book, if mm-hmm. there's no letter E, does the translator now take on a role almost equal to the author? I don't know.
Very much so, yeah. That's another great question. Ulipian translation is its own and in the case of the book without the letter E, for instance, it's been translated into English three different times. One of which has been published. There's one called A Void, which is the version that's published. It's translated by Gilbert Adair, and you can go buy it. There's a version called A Vanishing, and there's a version called Vanished, V-A-N-I-S-H apostrophe D exclamation point. And so I've never done a side-by-side comparison of the three of them, but all of them sort of highlight different approaches that the translator took to the same constraint. And obviously the more constraints there are within a single text, the more multiplied the sort of recreation that the translator is obligated to do are. There are certainly, like when I translated the Canoe poem without keeping the rhyme, it was just a rough literal translation, and that certainly serves its own purpose, but to translate Perec's E-list novel literally would be totally to miss the point. which is not to say that it can't be done and may have been done. There's a famous story about how one of the first people to review Perec's Elis novel when it came out wrote this review that was like, this book is okay. It's clearly very political, and there's some violence, and it's just, you know, it just doesn't quite land. And it became clear that the reviewer didn't notice that the book didn't have the letter E in it, and so reviewed it as just a normal novel, which is a really fascinating case study in whether or not you should let the reader in, and it sort of ports over to the question of translation. But it's a really lively question that I'm not going to be able to do justice to here. But very much so, the translator of an Oulipian work is often as much a new kind of author, a sort of recreator, than just a person taking one thing and moving it over to a different language.
Sorry, just to follow on from that, are there any translators who are part of Oulipo?
Sure. I'm a translator. Ian Monk is a translator. We both translate from French to English, I think. There are two Spanish members who have joined the group recently who tend to translate a fair amount from Spanish, from French into Spanish. Those are the only examples I can think of right now, but certainly. Because not only is translation of an Oulipian text, Harry Matthews was also translated quite a lot. Not only is translating an Oulipian text a sort of Oulipian action, but translation itself has a lot of elements that if you poke and prod and, you know, pull at one string and translate in a certain way or set yourself constraints of translation, which every translator does when he or she decides how faithful to be to the voice versus the exact wording, that is sort of in itself a very Oulipian enterprise.
I may have missed it. Can you just, Howard Horowitz, Manhattan?
Yeah. I didn't say anything about that.
I'm intrigued.
I don't actually know very much about him.
Oh, okay.
I found this image very recently. This is it's a poem in the shape of Manhattan,
right,
about Manhattan. I don't know. I'll get
He's
back to you.
He's an aspiring Oulipian?
Maybe. There's a rule that every Oulipian, there can never be another Oulipian with the same set of initials as somebody who's already in the Oulipo, and fortunately there are no HHs. So he has a shot, yeah. If anyone knows Harold Horowitz, please pass on the good news.
Are there cases where the presentation of a poem would have to happen in a certain place or in a certain kind of space?
Yeah, there's some examples, none that really come to mind as great in response to this question, but there's sort of a middle ground that I didn't really talk about between writing in a public place and that being the space where the text lives, and you know, writing on the page. For instance, there are a lot of particularities of presentation within still a conventional book format, a conventional publishing format. And the one a really good example is a book that's often talked about as the first Oulipian book is a book by Kuno called 100,000 Billion Poems. And what it is it's 10 sonnets, and a sonnet is 14 lines. 10 sonnets that all have identical rhyming structure. So all 10 sonnets have the first line ends with the sound ease, and the third line ends with the same sound. And so the book is printed, it's 10 pages, one with each sonnet, but there are strips. Each page is cut into strips. There are slits between each line. So in theory, you can move the flaps of each poem, of each line, to recombine, to sort of make a combinatorial poem. I wish I could show you a picture or show you an example of the book, actually. And there it is. So you can recouple, you can have the first line from the first poem and the second line from the third poem and the fourth line from the fifth poem. And in this way, you can theoretically make up 10 to the 14th, because there are 10 times 14 lines, 10 to the 14th, or 100,000 billion different poems. So that is a use of the book as space, which I might have covered, but didn't have time to, sort of a talk unto itself, that if you have me back one day, I will go into more detail on. Does that kind of answer your question?
I was wondering if
Oh, sorry. Gotta wait for the microphone.
I was wondering if the poems would if some poems would have to be presented within a physical space outside of the poem, or if there's some sort of physical interaction between the poem and the place.
Not that many, besides what I've talked about. The other example that I'll give is a poem by Christian Book, who is a Canadian writer who is not a member of the Ulipo, but the author of many extremely Ulipian works, including a book called Eunoia, which is a set of monovocalic poems. So the first poem has only A is its only vowel. Then there's one where E is its only vowel, etc. And his most recent project is called the Xenotext. And it consists of, basically, he encoded a poem into the DNA of a bacterium that over time, over the next, like, and it's not just any bacterium, but like the most indestructible bacterium known to science. And so over the next several centuries and millennia, the poem will eventually express a counterpart poem through its bacterial erosion. I'm not doing that good a job of explaining it, but I also, like, there's not really a way of explaining it where it doesn't sound insane. So that's kind of another example. But as far as poems that need to be displayed in physical locations, not much else comes to mind. I'll think about it, though.
I just had a question, because you were talking about mathematics and you were talking about constraints. And at one moment, you made it a point to speak about human, like human agency within that kind of context, as a response to one of the questions. And I think this example that you just mentioned kind of lends itself to the question, is there a reason that there is non-human agency in your translations or in the way that you think about algorithmic processes or writing or reading machines? You have an imaginary author who's also part of the group, but let's say, for example, is there a reason there isn't like a computational translating partnership or something where you start to explore the idea of constraint in a way where you value the constraint and the framework for that so much? And these examples, I think, lend themselves more to that process not being tied to an act of writing that's traditional and orthodox in a way. Mm-hmm. So I'm just kind of curious, because of the group's interest also in having graph theorists and mathematicians and so forth, if that world of algorithmic authorship was ever something that was discussed.
Yes. It sort of had its moment in the 1980s, and it culminated in the creation of not really a subcommission, but sort of a sister group to the Ulipo called the Alamo, which is another acronym in French. It's sort of like the workshop for literature assisted by mathematics and computers. And so that is the explicitly algorithm-based branch of Ulipian inquiry. And it still exists, although it's not, it's certainly not as well known and not very robust in terms of its membership or its activities. And I think the fact that emerged as a separate channel that the Ulipo was aware of but didn't have to invest its energies in sort of made the question moot from then on. I'm asked that question a fair amount, and I tend to respond in the way that you've already sort of hinted at, that I think humanism is a very important part of the Ulippian project. That really the interesting, and you know, you can also make the case that the choice of constraint, building the algorithm, is a very human and choice-filled enterprise. But I think the Ulippo is so interested in process and the things that happen during the process that to automate it would seem also to miss the point a little bit. The other answer, the more earthbound answer, is just that most of the members of the Ulippo are pretty old. And I think, excuse me, entrusting this sort of work to a computer is not necessarily scary or dystopian for them, but it's just not something that they've ever been that interested in. And I think the coming years will determine how much more we want to let in the influence of computers and algorithms and outsourcing some of the work that the Ulippian constraint leads to automation. I don't really know how that's going to go, but I think for now it just hasn't been a question that's come up that much.
Yeah, I guess it wasn't so much about speaking about automation, but in terms of exercising, let's say, a higher order of constraint mm-hmm. as a conceptual tool. It's not necessarily about automating processes of translation like Google Translate, but really about working solely on the project of constraint in a way that actually removes that singular authorship, right? In some way, for example, all of those texts could then be synthesized through a vision of a way of reading them that could be understood solely through those kind of mechanisms that you guys set up. That seems to be the generator, if it's explicitly somehow encoded in that and made legible, or if it's actually more abstract in a sense, it seems that that's part of the fundamental praxis of the things that you guys are doing. So it's just something that came to mind listening to some of the questions and the conversations.
Yeah, it's a good point. I don't think I can't answer that interestingly right now. I think what you just said is more interesting than anything that I can say about it. So, seems like a cop out, but sorry. Yeah. So.
Any further questions? One last question.
Hello. You showed briefly the constant New Babylon picture, mm-hmm. and you referred to the Situationists. Was there any crossover or dialogue between the two groups? I mean, I know they were involved in different projects, but...
Yeah. Short answer, no. I mean, they were sort of... I think the dawn of the Ulippo coincided with the sunset of the Situationists as, you know, really important cultural actors in Paris. Some of the founding members of the Ulippo were... certainly, you know, in touch with and sometimes active in Dada and Situationism and Lettrism and nobody, I think Surrealism was pretty much verboten because Queneau had such a bad experience with Breton in the 20s. But, and pataphysics also is another really important sort of origination point for the Ulippo. But, beyond the fact that all of these people were sort of marinating in the same cultural stew in Paris, more formally than that, there were not really connections. No.
Okay, one last question.
I'm here all night.
How has the group's work permeated into music?
I'm sorry?
Music. How has it permeated into music?
The Ulippo's work doesn't have much to do with music, but as it turns out, there are quite a large handful of, not sister groups, but counterpart groups called the U something else pose. So there is an Umupo, which is instead of Workshop for Potential Literature, it's the Workshop for Potential Music. There actually have been three different Umupos because they have sort of over time, there have been some that have come and gone and experienced great sort of infrastructural troubles. But there's an Umupo, there is an Ubapo, which is constrained cartooning, which is really cool. There's an Upampo for painting, Ufopo for photography, and so on. There's actually... take the easy way out and find the... There are... So music is a really good example of taking the same kind of attitude that is at the origin of Ulippian inquiry, and instead of literature, looking at music. So what if instead of a 12-tone scale, you use an 11-tone scale? What if you sort of, you know, think about Schoenbergian surrealism and think about that? And there are quite a lot of U-expos that do serious work and quite a lot that are completely absurd. There's like workshop for potential pornography, the workshop for potential cartography, which is actually pretty legit. It's like the workshop for potential gardening. There's a chapter in here that sort of inventories a lot of them that I can't find right now. But that sort of like the Alamo and being a release valve for the energy that might have otherwise taken up a lot of the time within the Ulippo. These U-expos, which are not really officially sanctioned or governed by the Ulippo, they have more to do with pataphysics, in fact. They sort of allow the Ulippo to exist and keep abreast of other parallel explorations without having to, you know, recruit a member who's going to be able to explain to everyone what serialism is and what a 12-tone scale is. So there's quite a lot of it, and I am not all that well-versed in it. There's an album, I forget the guy's name, he recorded this album as Angel and the Hidden Tracks, and it's an album where the lyrics don't contain the letter E, and the E, like E as a note, is just not present anywhere on the album. And so on into more abstract sort of compositional techniques.
Okay.
Thank you, everybody.
Thank you very much, Daniel, for joining us.